Thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings from Faith Radio. Good morning. It is the 14th of June and the sun is up. The tomb is still empty. That is the good news of the kingdom. I am Dr. Peter Kapsner and we are here with Faith Radio Mornings. Logan Rausch on the board in studio, Paul Perot on the news. Great to be with you again this morning on a beautiful sunshiny day here just outside of Minneapolis, Minnesota is the home studio. You know, Logan, one of my favorite passages of scripture is comes out of Hebrews 12. And it comes right on the heels of reflecting on this journey of faith that so many people walked, where they followed God into the unknown, not certain of where they were headed, didn't know where they were going, but they kept following out. And so then the author of Hebrews, right after that, says these words, "Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and we fix our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer and the perfecter of our faith." Do you have anybody in your life, Logan, you think about that has kind of walked out this journey before and kind of inspires you to keep moving forward in this crazy journey of life?
I can't think of anyone who doesn't apply to that. I mean, I talk about a scripture verse that anyone can take. I mean, we all feel the sense of not knowing where we're going in life and wanting to figure that out. But it's not about knowing where you're going. It's about trusting that where you're being sent is the right place to go.
Great words. And that really is the key to the kingdom, is willing to bend your knee and trust. It's one of the toughest things to do. We try to create this illusion of control. Of course, it always eludes our grasp. And so let's keep walking this out, pioneer, perfecter. Got a great show this morning as well. We're going to start with a regular guest, Ben Johnson of the Acton Institute. We'll get rolling with him in just a minute, talk a little North Korea, as well as some things about some recent statistics on abortion, follow-up conversation last week. We'll get started with Ben in just a moment. Welcome to the show, everybody.
My right, a right given by God, deliver free life.
Good morning, just about 8 minutes past the hour here, and we are joined now by our regular guest here, Thursday mornings, Ben Johnson of the Acton Institute. And the Acton Institute is sort of this American think tank that looks at some of the principles required to have a society that is free and just and virtuous, and Ben, a senior editor there, does quite a bit of writing on current events, and I know is one of Bill's favorite guests week in and week out. And so, Ben, great to have you on the show this morning. I'm Dr. Peter Kapsner, and lovely to meet you here, at least over the airwaves. Bill had nothing but great things to say about you.
And I'm sure the listeners enjoy having you on, Peter, so thank you. Good to meet you as well.
Well, you know, I understand, Ben, you know, Logan was telling me this morning that you are a huge soccer fan. I guess I don't know if that's true, but the world, we got to start with the headline of the World Cup. And is there anybody you're sort of cheering for with the United States being out of this deal? We got kicked out pretty early on this World Cup competition.
To lay all my cards on the table, I hate to disagree with Logan, but I hate, loathe, and despise soccer.
You hate, loathe, and despise soccer, Ben. Why is it? Is it because it's hard to get your head around how a nil-nil game could be exciting? You got to understand, Logan loves soccer, so this nil-nil deal, and it's an exciting match. I have a hard time understanding that, Ben. How about you?
I really do. I understand you can have seesaw back and forth and things like that. I've just never been into it. Children enjoy playing it and so on, but I've just never enjoyed watching it.
Yeah, I know. A goal a week when you're following a match and a team and stuff, it's pretty good. Logan, anything? I mean, you know, we'll transition to a second, but this World Cup's really important. You want to defend yourself for a minute?
I don't know where you got this information that I told you Ben was a soccer lover, but...
Yeah, we just started to make some stuff up as we go along here. But so, Logan, we need a little counterpoint, though. Why is soccer exciting?
Listen, I could spend a year talking about this, so I'm just going to say national coverage, the world comes together for it, 3 billion people watch it, there's a reason it's loved.
So you're suggesting Ben is in the minority. Okay, well, we'll follow that up at the break. But Ben, as we, there's some headlines obviously coming out of North Korea that do relate to this idea of a free and virtuous society, something that we wouldn't use to describe North Korea historically. But some of what's coming out is that maybe this society is going to begin to open up if things keep moving forward. And one of the ways in which it might is the idea of bringing free market and capitalism and even McDonald's into North Korea. Have you been following this at all? What's your take on this?
There's been some talk about this, of course, with President Trump finally meeting for the very first time with the dear leader of North Korea, Kim Jong-un, in Singapore this week. There's been sort of a rapturous coverage of this, particularly among those on the right. Kim Jong-un did agree to an agreement that said he was going to pursue the complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, quote unquote. That's what he's committed to, and we will hope that something concrete comes out of that. However, people who've looked at the agreement itself say that this agreement is somewhat vague. The actual enforcement mechanism, the verification process, is weak, to say the least. And so all these things will have to be filled in at some point. My sense of it is that Kim Jong-un came to the table because he thought that Donald Trump was really going to follow through, that he really was as crazy and as overheated as his tweets might suggest. And it scared him. So he decided to come forward. He realized that unlike Bill Clinton or Barack Obama, he wasn't going to get another nuclear reactor or hundreds of millions of dollars of food for his million-man army. So I think that that's probably what brought this to the fore. What will actually come of it, we can only hope and pray. I would love to see the nation open up. I would love to see denuclearization. I would particularly love to see the millions of people who are essentially his prisoners in a one-nation gulag finally be able to breathe freely, and for all the political prisoners to be released, particularly those who are being tortured. I wish I were sanguine enough to believe it was going to happen, but at the risk of raining on the parade, I have to maintain my skepticism.
Are you looking for any markers at all, just steps along the way in which you'd say, now, hang on, maybe we are indeed moving past political rhetoric and into some actual tangible steps towards a real lasting shift within North Korea? Are there any markers for that sort of thing?
I think you would have to have concrete nuclear inspections that can be verified. I think you would have to have surveillance photography that shows that at a minimum the one nuclear site that we are certain of has been shut down, and human intelligence is almost impossible to come by in North Korea. It's unlikely that there will be any sort of verification, say, from the IEA. But when we have reasonable intelligence that says that they're complying with that, that would be one positive step. Another would be opening up the economy in any way, even to the people who live in North Korea itself, and make it more amenable for them to open businesses. And, of course, ultimately, to grant the right of freedom of speech, freedom of expression, freedom of movement around and outside borders. And if that happens, North Korea is going to empty out. So I think that that will probably be the last step. But at least freeing the economy, freeing the press, and assuring that they're closing down the nuclear reactor would be, at a minimum, what I would look for. And all those things are in such a premature area that we can't say whether that's going to happen or not. I certainly hope and pray for the best.
Yeah, and with China obviously having a significant influence in that part of the world and so much of a trading partner as well with North Korea, it seems like they could exert an influence that can our expectation really be that at the end of the day, North Korea is going to look like sort of a miniature America in the Asian seaboard?
Yes, and of course, the question has been for decades, how do you get China to exert that pressure? Presidents have tried for decades, going back at a minimum to George W. Bush, but Bill Clinton to some extent as well. And for the most part, it's been through carrots. And Barack Obama, of course, offered this as well. But Donald Trump brought out the stick in the terms of tariffs and other sanctions against Beijing. That may have been part of the background of what made this deal come about. It's hard to say for a fact, but without knowing the inside story, which will come about, I'm sure, in the days after the administration's come to a close. I'm just glad that someone is finally bringing the human rights of North Korea into the forefront. I hope that they don't get lost in the shuffle of our rapture over the denuclearization agreement.
Well, it'd be interesting to watch the steps in the days ahead. We're speaking with Ben Johnson of the Acton Institute, regular guest here on Faith Radio mornings. We'll take a short break. Ben is going to catch up on some of the soccer headlines. And when we come back, we'll transition into some North America conversation. Great to hear your voice, Ben. We'll be back in a minute. It's 17 minutes past the hour, and the sun is up, and as we said, the tomb is empty. The good news still exists. We're talking with Ben Johnson, our regular contributor here on Thursday mornings from the Acton Institute, talking all things relative to a free and open society, a virtuous society as well. And Ben, I confess, I don't know much, as we were talking about North Korea, about the education system in North Korea, but you wrote a really interesting article around the education system in Germany and some of what's happening there, comparing the German strikes of the teachers there with what this red state revolt or red state revolution that supposedly is happening in the United States in teacher strikes. So can you kind of walk us through a little bit of your article and comparing this teacher strike in Germany versus the United States?
Well, they're definitely a study in contrast. You know, we ended the school year in the United States with the red state revolt you referred to. These are statewide teacher union strikes in West Virginia, Oklahoma, and Arizona, and some other actions around the country in Colorado and North Carolina and other states where teachers are going on strike. But just so happened that this very week, the German equivalent of the Supreme Court, what they call their Federal Constitutional Court, ruled on a case exactly about this issue. In Germany, 75% of all teachers are ruled what they call public servants. And the Federal Constitutional Court says that public servants can't strike. If you're going to be a public servant, you have to serve with a servant's heart. So the German model has always been that people who are classified as public servants have better benefits than those in the public in the private sector. It's almost impossible to fire them. They have tremendous loyalty, but it expects the employee's loyalty in return. And part of that loyalty is they're not allowed to go on strike, which is also something that someone as liberal as Franklin Roosevelt believed when he was president of the United States. He said he didn't even believe that government workers should have unions because essentially they're organizing against the U.S. taxpayer and that a strike would bring the government to a halt. So the Federal Constitutional Court in Germany ruled teachers cannot go on strike there. That's how they handle teacher strikes, and they believe that teachers have to be servants with a servant's heart. In the United States, we have sort of this hybrid system that's the worst of all worlds, where government workers, both not merely teachers, but federal workers and others, are almost impossible to fire. Teachers who have tenure are very difficult to fire, but government workers, bureaucrats, are virtually impossible to fire for anything other than gross criminal negligence. And yet they still have the right to collectively bargain and to go on strike. To give you an idea of how bad it is, in Delaware, legislators introduced a bill that would finally give the state the power to revoke teachers' licenses if the teacher had been proven to be an imminent threat to the student's physical safety. And they highlighted the fact that a teacher had shoved an autistic child and is still eligible to teach, still has a Delaware teaching license. Another had inappropriately touched young girls, is still working in Delaware public schools. So with that kind of government protection, do they really need more job security?
It's such a tricky balance of tension between it, because I suppose there'd be people that would argue on the flip side that what do you do if there is administrative abuse, if there are superintendents that are acting inappropriately or making decisions on behalf of the school district that is really causing some sort of hardship among the teachers? I mean, is there ever a reason for, on the flip side, for teachers to be able to strike in America versus a place like Germany?
I would say that in the United States, if we were to adopt the German idea of public service or the Christian idea of serving with a servant's heart, then strikes would be out of the way. You know, Christians try to strive for harmony among one another. We don't go to court against one another to the extent that that's humanly possible. When it comes to someone who's an administrator who's abusing their authority, there's always a higher administrator when it comes to a government. So it may be a local supervisor, and you can go to the state level. The state, you can go to the U.S. Department of Education. There's always a higher level that you can appeal to. And if enough people appeal, it's very easy to have government spring into action. and to root out issues where people are abusing their authority. But teachers always say that the highest social good you can give a child is a government education. And by teacher strikes, they're deliberately denying children the very thing that they're asking for in order to get more money. So I think the only good thing that can come out of this is that maybe some parents who were at home realize they really can do without government schools and they have the talent to homeschool after all.
This is such a tricky, obviously, as we said, conversation. There's so many dynamics. The school systems are there's more and more children in the classroom. I know my brother teaches in a high school, and he talks about even as a teacher these days having 30, 35, 40 students in a class. And now we have worries about gun and violence in schools. And so to try to figure out a healthy partnership is what I'm hearing between the superintendents and the administration and our teachers, where they're actually for one another and there's not this antagonism between them. The idea of the civil servant is that there's a trusted relationship between the two is what I hear you saying.
And that has to go both ways. That's right. Yeah, the government has to give that trust and support to the employees and generally has. And on the other hand, the employees have to have that servant's heart. Every teacher that I know, including my mother, have that servant's heart. They simply go into this because they love children. Usually it's the government's making it more difficult through mandated testing and teaching to the test and things of that sort that make it more difficult for them to express their concern for children. But I think that when teachers go into this, that is their real consideration. And for the most part, quite often union leaders and a small group of people who are dedicated to ginning up controversy, in some cases, simply to either for minimal advantage or to justify their own paychecks as organizers.
Talking with Ben Johnson of the Acton Institute this morning. Ben, we just have a few minutes left. I do want to transition the conversation to wrap up some things from last week as well, where you had talked a bit about abortion and some of the changing statistics of attitudes relative to abortion in America, specifically related to restrictions in the second and the third trimester. Can you kind of walk us through what's been happening, some of the shifting views here in our country?
Yeah, the Gallup just released a new poll this week, and it found that while most people support abortion for its legality in the first trimester, when it comes to the second trimester, less than a third of Americans believe that abortion should be legal in the second trimester. That means beginning at 12 weeks, only 28% of Americans believe that abortion should be legal at 12 weeks. That's twice as long as the limit that the Supreme Court has imposed on the states. When you get into the third trimester, it falls down to 13%. So a majority does not believe in abortion on demand. Even during the first trimester, when Gallup asks about abortion for any reason, only 45% approve of abortion for absolutely any reason. So when it comes right down to it, we have nearly as many people who would believe that abortion is morally acceptable as believe it's immoral. However, when you look into the fine details, the American people want greater restrictions on abortion. And for the most part, it's the Supreme Court which is denying the ability to impose these. An interesting statistic, by the way, men are actually more likely to say abortion should be legal than women. Women are more likely to say abortion should be illegal in all circumstances. But I think what this shows, this is a case where the government is denying human rights that people want to recognize, which is politically and morally inverted.
And we just have a minute left in that. I know this is going to continue to heat up, especially with the potential retirement of some of the Supreme Court justices to maybe revisit the Roe versus Wade. What are you looking for with Justice Kennedy and the potential of retirement and what that might mean for abortion? We just have about a minute left on this one.
Kennedy is the swing voter on the Supreme Court on this and so many other issues, and that's going to make this the ugliest confirmation battle that we've seen since Robert Bork, possibly uglier than what we saw 31 years ago with Robert Bork when he was nominated to the Supreme Court by President Ronald Reagan. Kennedy is the hinge on which so many liberal policies hang that they are going to go all out in order to try and make sure that no one who is to the right of Kennedy is nominated. And I think we're going to have to gear up for a very ugly battle indeed.
Ben Johnson, Acton Institute, great as always. When we catch up again next week, Ben, I'm going to want to know who you are following specifically in the World Cup. We'll just kind of walk through that. I'm sure that you know your Middle Eastern soccer countries, and so we'll look forward to your reflections on that. Ben, great to hear your voice this morning again. We'll take a break, head into Lighten Up and a little laughing this morning, come back, do news in the second half of the hour. Thirty minutes past the hour. We'll take a break for news in just a minute. A couple other quick headlines. That is President Trump's birthday today, 72 years old for our president. And also, Logan, you're telling me it was Flag Day today. Mm-hmm. And so how are you celebrating Flag Day, Logan?
I don't own an American flag.
You don't?
Actually, I do in a terms of a very nice summer tank top.
Okay.
I could wear that to work, but I don't know that Dick would allow that.
Yeah, I think I might have to go through some therapy if you roll with that tomorrow morning. So I'll take a break for news. Great first part of the hour with Ben Johnson. Second part of our show, we'll have an interview with Neil Stavem and Danny Huerta talking about summer jobs coming up here after the news. We've been listening this week to John Ortberg during these little breaks around discernment and finding the will of God, one of the most common questions my students ask. And John is going to tell us a little bit about discernment and the ABCs of that right now.
When we think about the will of God and wanting the will of God, these three steps are wonderful in that process, because sometimes I can say to myself, I want the will of God for my life, when really what I want is my own agenda. What I really want is just a guarantee that would say, this job will make you successful, or, you know, this relationship will make you happy. And, of course, that's not primarily God's will. That's my will. And following the will of God or going through those open doors isn't about my own agenda or my own life. And that's where abandon, it starts with abandon. I actually have to abandon my own life. So I let go of my demand from God for security and comfort, or maybe for wealth, or maybe for fame, or whatever that is. I actually have to let go of what it is that I think I've got to have for my life to be happy and meaningful. And then I come to believe that God will actually have an open door for me. And I think a lot of people struggle here. A lot of people think, well, maybe for somebody else, maybe for the Apostle Paul or the Apostle Peter, or maybe for Beth Moore or Max Licato, but not me. So what I have to come to believe is not just that there's a God, but God is concerned about my life and God has something for me to do. And then the commit part's really critical, because it's not enough just to say I believe that in an abstract way. I'm actually going to have to make some decisions. I'm going to have to make commitments that involve my money. I'm going to have to make commitments that involve my time. I have to make commitments that will involve me stepping out to do something, to volunteer, to lead, to serve, in a way that's going to be scary to me. And so those ABCs are just wonderful steps.
It's Pastor John Ortberg talking about a topic I think affects all of us, discerning the will of God. You can find the full segment of that on myfaithradio.com. Search for Ortberg, discernment, anything along those lines to catch the entirety of that. Coming up in just a minute, we'll have Neil Stavem talking in an interview with Danny Huerta about summer jobs. Stay with us.
How you live as a Christian in today's culture makes a difference on the culture itself. This is Jim Garlow. There's an economic theory that says what we enjoy in terms of economics in our culture flows out of, in part, biblical truth. A book titled Human Accomplishments studied the accomplishments of humanity from 400 BC to 1950. It was written by a self-admitted agnostic. But he said that when he studied human accomplishments, he was stunned that the primary contributor to human accomplishment, meaning things getting better, was because of biblical Christianity. Another book titled Under the Influence came up with the same conclusion. Christianity, when lived out by those of us who claim to know Christ, makes an enormous impact on culture, even the economy. A staggering impact, in fact. Let's not forget that. Let's live in light of God's truth, salt and light. This is Jim Garlow.
Next up on Faith Radio Mornings, we're talking summer jobs. You know, school's out and summer break is here, and maybe your student is hoping they can just hang out at the pool or summer camp all summer. And most parents are hoping their teens are going to learn to work hard, both helping around the house and also at a summer job. Are they available? And why is a summer job important? We'll talk about it next with Danny Huerta. Danny is vice president of the Parenting and Youth Department at Focus on the Family. And he is also a licensed clinical social worker, working in the areas of conflict resolution and anxiety and depression in children and more. And he's been a guest on Faith Radio in the past. Danny, welcome back. How you doing?
Neil, thanks for having me on the show. I'm doing great. I appreciate it.
So we're going to talk about summer jobs. I think most parents would like their kids to have some sort of a work experience, but that's not necessarily seems like it happens quite as often these days.
No, in fact, there's a recent study done, and they said in the late 1970s, 65% of teens 16 to 19 were working outside the home. And now, today, it's about 30 to 35%. But I think there's some reasons why. And I would say one is some people are working later in their life and are actually attaining some of those jobs that otherwise would be teen jobs in the past. And then also, some of the kids are taking on unpaid internships now or doing summer school to get ahead so that they get some of the college credits. And then some are having to play year-round sports now. And there's a lot of summer leagues and tournaments and camps and things like that that they're involved in. And so it makes it harder to have a summer job. Yet it's very, very important, crucial for kids' development as they're entering into the adulthood years. And I would say that most teens would not disagree that they want the money that comes with
sure.
with the summer job. And then parents wouldn't disagree that it's important for their kids. So I think this is an important topic.
You know, you mentioned internships. But it seems like that is playing a much bigger role, right, that kids need to almost like sort of pad their resume. And so do they choose doing a volunteer project instead of actually picking up a job at a burger joint?
Yeah, and really the benefits are just as equal, except for the money management piece that you get with having a job, you know, managing your money and appreciating money because you earned it. The unpaid internships, those volunteer hours, are critical for some people, depending on what professions they're going into, to, like you said, pad the resume, build it up, build that foundation of the resume. It's very competitive out there to get some of the career jobs, and so you have to look at whatever advantages. That's a thing that is a reality today in the workforce. It's not as easy to find a job. So what a challenge, right? Yet the skills learned on either one are critical. You learn accountability. You learn how to be organized. You learn a sense of confidence. And I think the biggest one for me is you learn some perseverance. You work through stress, you work through disagreements, you work through boredom, and it creates a level of resilience that's important down the road when you're in college or doing a career. It helps you develop those initial skills to plow through some more difficult scenarios and situations when you're in a job for the long haul.
Because those early jobs, often they're not high paying and they're not high skilled, and so you're the perseverance part, you're running into maybe a manager who has opinions on how things should be done, and you don't necessarily know. So talk a little bit about that. If you're, you know, you don't have that work experience, it can be a little daunting.
Yeah, you know, certain personalities would be able to handle that better than others. There's some kids with personalities where they're just cooperative. It doesn't bug them. They'll just say, sure, yes, sir, yes, ma'am, I'll do it. And they go ahead and do whatever they're told to do. And then you have stronger opinionated personalities that are going to have a real hard time with a boss coming in, especially if it's a highly opinionated boss and just comes in and lays down the law. That's going to be an adjustment and knowing how to respect that person, how to cooperate within the team and still work under that boss and continue to work with excellence. Because we say whenever we're doing work, we're doing it for God. We're not doing it for the person that's above us. We're doing it with excellence because God has created us as co-creators. And whatever job we're in, if we're faithful in those little things, He'll give us bigger things to be faithful in. And we're not doing it to get the bigger things, but it's about really building the building blocks to become who God has created us to be, as it says in Ephesians 2:10, that we're his masterpieces created do great things, and we get to step into those. But there's a process to that. You got to pay your dues, and sometimes for those personalities, the ones that are not as opinionated, they have to learn how to become opinionated within a work and have a voice, place of employment, have a voice within that, and be assertive. And then the other kids that are too assertive, maybe they need to learn how to be a little more humble and take more of the recommendations and input from other people. That's great growth for anybody going into those.
I was thinking there's a limit to how much a parent can instill in a child, and maybe how much the rubbing of the rough edges happens with the siblings, right? Work experience is probably maybe one of the only ways you can really learn some of these things.
Yes, I was talking about personalities a little earlier. The personality differences that you're going to have within the work and the different work ethics make it maybe sometimes seem unfair, or maybe there are other dynamics that are created by that. And what you get to do is go in there and do the best you can with what you've been told to do and given to do. And if you can, showing up early, if you can, also going above and beyond within that job that you're given, because it's going to set the foundations for your future jobs and future relationships. And one thing that's interesting is that balance is sometimes hard for kids. Some kids are hard workers, and all they want to do is work, and then they forget to play and relate and rest, and they just want to work hard, and that's great. But then the balance part is important to teach those kids. And then you have kids that just want to play, and they don't necessarily really feel like working or want to work, and that's where they get to they've gotten the play part down, and you want to teach them how to expand that to working and making work a fun thing. It's an opportunity for growth and maybe creating a new paradigm in their mind about what work represents. So as parents, you're not only teaching them the relational aspect of work, but also the balance of relationship and play outside of work with and entering this great opportunity of working. And that's a great role for a parent to be in, seeing, hey, Here's some balance. Here's the pie chart, and here's the amount of time you're at work, amount of time you're resting. What do you think would be the best balance for you as you're growing up, and so you can find satisfaction in life overall, and making sure you're still having that time to relate to people and also to God when you have the moments.
Danny Huerta is Vice President of Parenting and Youth Department at the Focus on the Family, and he is a parent, so we'll maybe talk to him about his kids. And when we come back from this break, we'll talk about our first jobs and kind of just compare notes and see if we learned any lessons. And that Danny Huerta is joining us here on The Morning Show on Faith Radio. We're talking today with Danny Huerta, who serves as the vice president for the Parenting and Youth Department at Focus on the Family, and he's a licensed clinical social worker. And Danny, I'm just interested in what, if you remember what your first job was, maybe your first official job, and whether it was a summer job or just something that happened maybe after school.
Well, it was a different time back then. I'm not that old, but it was a different time, and I had a paper route when I first came from Mexico City at 8.5 years old. I had my first paper route with the Gazette Telegraph here in Colorado Springs and the Colorado Springs Sun. So I delivered newspapers in the morning and the evening, and that was great. I got to earn some money and keep in shape for sports, and then continued that till my senior year. Then after that, I got my first official job with an official paycheck was with Country Buffet and also a landscape company doing landscaping. And I continue to use the landscaping skills I learned from that to save myself some money, right?
Yeah, yeah. I may have to call you up here after the show, and maybe we can talk about doing some things. I think my first job off of the farm was my uncle owned a restaurant for a while, and so I got to do wash pots and pans and peel potatoes and all those kinds of things. And you know, the pay wasn't good, but the malts were great. And so, you know, is that one of the big things that we want kids to learn, is actually just the idea of that money doesn't just happen, and then how to manage money once we get it.
Yeah, it's a gratitude and appreciation for the value of money because you actually work hard for it. I think the also getting to experience the satisfaction of a job well done, much like when someone goes on a long run, you could say, boy, it'd be great to run, but you don't get the satisfaction of that long run at the end where it's that endorphin release, right? The great feeling after you've done a good run. Same thing with a job. When you look back, I think that's why some people love mowing. You look back and you see a well mowed lawn. It's just like God said, right? After creation, after those 6 days, he said, and he looked and it was good.
Yeah.
It's good to stop and look at the job we've done. And that's beneficial just in itself.
How do we maybe coach our kids into the kind of work that they might do well at, or does it really matter if they? I mean, there's a lot today about finding our strengths and understanding our personalities. Does it matter what kind of job that summer job is?
That's a great point, Neil. There is an importance to that. You want to guide your kids according to. You want to guide your kids according to who they've been created to be and guide them towards that job that maybe fits them well, maybe a job that they'll feel excited to be at, and you can help them learn what their skills are, their strengths, their interests, maybe write those down, and then look at what jobs would be a good fit for that as you're looking for jobs. That's important for job satisfaction and also success at the job. And once they have that piece, along with what you just mentioned earlier, with the money component they get, there's a great satisfaction to that, and then they'll be even more motivated to manage that money afterwards as well, to earn more and to be putting it in the different places, like the tithing bucket, the savings bucket, the spending bucket, all the different buckets of that. It's motivating when you're satisfied with a job, and then you get the money as well. It's a great combination. Long term, as a child steps into what it means to be an adult, we're introducing them to adulthood, and this is part of it. You can enjoy work, you can enjoy the fruits of the labor by just observing it, but also the money that you make from it. It's a great combination all the way around, but personality, it fits into all those areas. Some kids are great with managing money, some are not, so you can adjust the lessons there. There's some kids that love physical work and some that don't. And some that excel at that and some that don't, and maybe finding the jobs that fit their personality and also their body type as well.
You know, do we as parents sort of push our kids out to find something, even though, I mean, the unemployment is low in many places and maybe that they can't find something that works with their hours, or they don't want to work with their hours because they're doing sports. You know, they're playing on some team ball, and it's like they only have maybe 1 day a week to actually do something.
You know, get creative out there. My son's 15, my oldest child, and he's in marching band, and he's part of the basketball team as well, and they have tournaments, a few tournaments over the summer and some open gyms, and he's going to be going to youth summer camp for the spiritual growth as well, and he's going to do a woodworking camp. So that's a lot.
Yeah.
But on top of that, we went through the neighborhood and looked for some mowing jobs. He's got a couple mowing jobs, and then he's got there's an older couple that needed someone to do some yard work for them for several times this summer. And so, but we had to go out there and just help him seek those out, put out some neighborhood announcements that, hey, I'm available, but only to a limited amount. We said, hey, you need to have balance, so let's look at your schedule and figure out what fits and what you can consistently do and still enjoy and have some fun with friends and also as a family that we're spending time together. That just takes some intentionality as parents, and that's one of the seven traits that we emphasize in parenting. To be an effective parent is to be an intentional parent, and that's intentionally going in and figuring out the structure of what you're looking at and also developing creativity with your child. It doesn't have to be a formal job if you can't find one. And I had a client recently that said, no, I can't find a job, but I'm definitely not going to do a restaurant one. And this girl was 17, and there are plenty of jobs in restaurants, and she's really wanting a job to be able to earn money. But she decided, I'm just not going to do any restaurant. So we had to dig into, why is that? What is it about a restaurant that you feel is just not going to work for you? And there were some misconceptions, but I wanted to listen first. I wanted her parents to listen first so that we weren't trying to fix it for her or tell her what to do. He said, well, you could decide not to do a restaurant job instead of should. You could do that, decide not to, or you could decide to do it, but there are results either way. Maybe you'll end up without a job, and then you're wanting to do this missions trip, and you're needing money for that. So maybe it would be a good idea to expand your horizons a little bit to really get the bigger goal that you're looking for rather than getting so picky.
That's some good words. Advice, as always, from Dranny Huerta, who serves as Vice President of Parenting and Youth at Focus on the Family. And as we've been talking summer jobs, you know, thinking about responsibility, accountability, confidence, perseverance, those are some good traits that we all want and certainly want our kids to have as well. So, Danny, thanks for your encouragement. Just maybe a reminder of the kinds of resources available to Focus on the Family for, you know, those seven traits of parenting or anything else.
Yeah, please come to focusonthefamily.com/parenting, and you'll find free downloads and all kinds of other information, including a free assessment that is the seven traits of an effective parent. That's a great assessment to dig into and figure out how you're doing with those seven traits and how you can continue to build those in you, but also your children. And then also, if you're stuck with your child in conflict around this issue of working or any other issues, you can speak with one of our counselors for free. They're licensed, and that's through 1-800-A-FAMILY, 1-800-A-FAMILY, and you can enjoy talking to one of those counselors and see if you can come up with some next steps for you and your family.
Danny, great to talk with you today. Thanks for the good work you're doing.
Thank you so much, Neil. It's been an honor.
Great first hour. Ben Johnson in the first half of the hour, talking all things society and virtuous society. And then great conversation with Neil and Danny on summer jobs. We'll take a break for the top of the hour. And when we come back, first guest next hour is one of our favorites, Dr. David Aikman, coming up next. Stay with us.
Again, thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings. You can hear other podcasts at myfaithradio.com. Plus, remember, we are listener-supported, so your support makes Faith Radio Mornings and the other programs from Faith Radio possible. Make your gift at myfaithradio.com.